Hi, this is Eric Braden. I'm talking to Comic Book Central. I'll be damned. What an honor.
Hey there, fans of sci-fi, comic books, and all things super. Welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I am your host, Joe Stuber. Thanks so much for hanging out with me in the lair this week. Well, if you listened to last week's episode, my conversation with Castle's Susan Sullivan, you could probably read between the lines on a few of the comments she made about the future of that show, Castle. It's interesting to go back and re-listen to that chat in light of this week's Castle news. Huge news coming out of the world of Castle. Co-star Stana Katic and her castmate, Tamela Jones, not returning for season 9. That is, if there indeed is a season 9 to be had. A lot of rumors as to the future of the show. And obviously, from the cast comments, if you saw them on Twitter, most everyone was blindsided by the news. But it is interesting to hear Susan's comments about the future of the show before that announcement was made. Now, she didn't know anything that was going to happen at the time, but just kind of interesting to get a behind-the-scenes perspective from the weeks leading up to those announcements. So if you haven't listened to it yet, pretty cool episode, if I say so myself. At the end of today's show, you're going to want to go back and check that out. Good stuff. Great conversation. We talked about a lot of things. Not only Castle, but The Incredible Hulk, Justice League animated. A lot of good stuff. So check it out. If you did listen to last week's show, then at the end, you heard what was going to happen on this week's show. That's right. I'm going to do something I've never done before here on Comic Book Central. I am going to go ape.
It's a madhouse! A madhouse!
That's right. Planet of the Apes, one of the greatest sci-fi film franchises of all time. It's going to get some attention right here on Comic Book Central starting today. In just a few minutes, I'm going to hop in the Liberty One spacecraft, follow the Haslein curve back to the early 70s to chat with Dr. Otto Haslein himself, actor Eric Braden. Now, Eric co-starred in the third film of the series, Escape from the Planet of the Apes. We're going to talk about that film. Also, another sci-fi classic of his, Colossus, The Forbin Project. Multiple episodes of Wonder Woman that he was on, multiple episodes of $6 Million Man. Of course, his Emmy-winning role that made him an international star of daytime television, the role of Victor Newman from The Young and the Restless. All of that's coming your way today. Before we get to that chat, though, there are a few items I want to get to that might be of interest to you. First of all, I am back in the world of Indiana Jones on the latest episode of the IndieCast. You can check it out at theindiecast.com. Keith Voss and I weigh in on Indiana Jones 5. That was announced. We give our thoughts on that. Bring you our review of the Dark Horse Comics miniseries, Indiana Jones, Thunder in the Orient. That is there as well. If you are an Indiana Jones fan, download, stream the episode, enjoy some indie goodness. Host Ed Dalista and the rest of us IndieCasters, we are gearing up for Indie 5. So perfect time to subscribe to the show on iTunes if you haven't already.
In each fortnight to the IndieCast, the world's number one Indiana Jones fan podcast.
Trust me.
Featuring the latest news, reviews, and interviews with on-screen and behind-the-scenes talent who help bring to life the greatest adventure movie series ever made. Each episode has the latest from the world of Indiana Jones, as well as interactive segments, trivia, contests, and specials, including radio dramas and music retrospectives. The IndieCast.
It's a transmitter. It's a radio for speaking to God.
Available in iTunes or listen directly at theindiecast.com.
If adventure has a name, it must be the IndieCast.
Also, and this is big, big news, Comic Book Central Nation, I need your help. There is still time left to nominate Comic Book Central for a People's Podcast Award. This is your chance to share the lair in a big way. The instructions are posted on the Facebook and Twitter pages, facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork, Twitter at comicbookctrl. I've pinned them to the top so you can head there. But I'll also tell you how you can do it right now. You head to the website. It's podcastawards.com. That homepage is the nomination form. You can nominate Comic Book Central in two categories. First, People's Choice. That's going to be the first one. And then second, TV and film. So you're going to want to nominate it in both those categories. It closes, the window for nominations closes April 30th. So if you haven't done it yet, be sure to nominate Comic Book Central if you like what you're hearing. If this is the first time you're hearing it, listen to the Today Show. If you like it, go nominate it. Really appreciate everybody who's been doing that. Now, the instructions for the podcast name, of course, you type in Comic Book Central. That's the podcast name. For the URL, that is where you find it online, comicbookcentral.net. So when it asks for the URL, that's what you type in, comicbookcentral.net. You fill out those fields for both categories. Tell them how much you love Comic Book Central in the comments section. Assuming you do love Comic Book Central, right? I love all you guys, so hope you love the show as well. Name, email address, they're making sure that there are no ballot stuffers. They're keeping it fair for everyone. Then you send it along. Again, my thanks to everyone who has done just that. If you have not, just push pause right now. Take a minute to nominate Comic Book Central. I'll wait. All right, welcome back. Thanks for doing that. Thanks again. I'm telling you what, you folks are a big part of the success of the show. Let your voice be heard and share the lair. Get Comic Book Central nominated. Who knows? Maybe a nice award will take an honored place here in the lair. That'd be pretty awesome. So now for today's show, I do want to give a shout out to my buddies, Tony Mangus, also Derek Cook of Monster Kid Radio and Scott Morris of the Disney Indiana podcast. They're all huge fans of the Planet of the Apes series. And of course, Eric's flick, Colossus, the Forbin Project. They all sent some questions in. I'm going to mix those in with today's chat. So thanks to those guys for sending those in. If you haven't heard Derek and Scott reviewing the Planet of the Apes series on Monster Kid Radio, it's at monsterkidradio.net. Go check those episodes out. They're pretty cool. They're breaking down the films. Derek hadn't seen them yet, so he's kind of watching them from first-timer's perspective. Recently, they, along with Scott's wife, Tracy, they just finished reviewing Escape from the Planet of the Apes, so a great companion piece to today's interview with Eric Braden, so go check it out. I mentioned the Facebook and Twitter pages, some cool stuff I'm posting. If you love the film Escape from the Planet of the Apes, and who doesn't? It is an awesome film. I posted something very cool over on those feeds. I think you're going to like a lot. Back in the day, Power Records had a ton of licensed properties from everywhere. DC and Marvel Comics. They also had Star Trek. They had The $6 Million Man. Many, many others. And they had Planet of the Apes. For $1.49, you could get a comic book and a 45 RPM record. Remember those vinyl records? They had dialogue, sound effects, music. It brought the comic book to life. It really did. They produced book and record sets for four of the five Planet of the Apes films. Escape was one of them. Someone married the audio to the images from the book. They put it on YouTube. I posted that on the Comic Book Central Facebook page and Twitter pages. So if you want to check it out, head over to those pages. Take a look and take a listen. Very cool stuff. All right, now on to today's conversation. I'm going to go back in and access the database here in the lair, drop a little knowledge on you about my special guest today. Then I'm going to be right back to chat with Eric Braden. Eric Braden can be seen daily on television screens in over 30 countries on five continents, 36 years on The Young and the Restless, nearly 2,500 episodes, over 800 soap magazine covers, more than double the amount of any actor in daytime history, 7 Emmy nominations, and an Emmy Award for The Mantle. Not bad for a young Hans Gudegast from Kiel, Germany, who started out early as an athlete and immigrated to the U.S. in the 50s and went on to become one of the busiest guest stars of American television. Early roles included appearances on Combat, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and Mission Impossible, all before he landed the role of Captain Hans Dietrich on the 60s action-adventure series The Rat Patrol. At the dawn of the 70s, Hans took the name Eric Braden, and he took motion picture audiences by storm in back-to-back sci-fi classics. First, Colossus, The Forbin Project, where Eric played Dr. Charles Forbin, the chief designer of the secret national defense supercomputer Colossus. It's not long, however, before Colossus starts to take over and assumes control of its human creators.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Dr. Charles Forbin. In a few moments, Colossus will address us directly.
This is the voice of world control. I bring you peace. It may be the peace of plenty and contempt, or the peace of unburied death. The choice is yours.
obey and live, or disobey and die.
The following year, Eric landed the role of Dr. Otto Haslein in the time-trippy third entry in the wildly successful Planet of the Apes franchise, Escape from the Planet of the Apes. In the film, chimps Cornelius and Zira escape the destruction of Earth from the second film by traveling back in time to our day, thus setting in motion the rise of the apes.
With me this evening in the studio is Dr. Otto Haslein. He is a senior scientific advisor at the White House, and he'll be giving us his views on the crucial statement made at this morning's session. Dr. Haslein, as I recall, when you asked the male ape
where he was from, the female replied, "From your future."
Yes.
You believe that?
Absolutely. I think it is the only explanation. He would perceive, Mr. Bonds, that time is like a freeway with an infinite number of lanes, all leading from the past into the future, however, not into the same future. A driver in lane A may crash while a driver in lane B survives. It follows that a driver, by changing lanes, can change his future. Now, Mr. Bonds, I do not find it difficult to believe that in the dark and turbulent corridors of outer space, the impact of some distant planetary, even galactic disaster, jumped the apes from their present into ours.
And indeed, the proof lies in their arrival among us, and in their spoken, and I repeat, spoken testimony.
And while the film does have its humorous moments, the ending is brutal, dark, and sudden. A bold risk for the filmmakers, and a bold risk for Eric, who then continued his incredible streak of television guest appearances throughout the 70s, including two of our favorites, two episodes of Wonder Woman, including the pilot, and The $6 Million Man, starting with one of the original television movies. But in 1980, Eric took on the role for which he would become an international star, Victor Newman on the daytime drama The Young and the Restless, winning an Emmy for the role in 1998, the year after he appeared as John Jacob Astor in the James Cameron blockbuster Titanic. My guest today shot Steve Trevor out of the sky on the Wonder Woman television series. He flew through the skies with the $6 Million Man. And he also tried to prevent those apes from taking over the Earth in the Planet of the Apes series. He is the Emmy-winning actor who can be seen on your television every weekday on The Young and the Restless as Victor Newman. He's Eric Braeden. Eric, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Well, thank you very much. Judging by who the candidates are, apparently I wasn't very successful in keeping the apes from occupying the Earth, you know?
It's almost like I think you actually set it in motion. I think if, you know, depending on how you view the film, it could be that Haslein sets that in motion. It's an intricate script. We'll talk a little bit
almost
about that.
It's almost a Karl Rovian, Machiavellian move, isn't it?
And look, you're kind of known for playing bad guys. Is that fair enough?
That is fair enough.
And I think the way you approach these things, and maybe it's even the way some of these are written, it's like you always play these amazing bad guys because the motivations aren't necessarily evil. Always the bad. Is that how you sort of take these roles on, and how you kind of even justify like being the bad guy for all these years?
To be frank with you, well, in other words, yes, mostly bad guys. But you're absolutely right in surmising that I do it from a point of view where I don't think it's bad. In other words, the intentions are good. Certainly, they were in that Planet of the Apes thing. So what motivates Victor Newman are a number of things, but he grew up, as you perhaps have realized on the show, as he grew up in an orphanage and was left at the age of seven and has been on his own ever since. So when that happens to you, you obviously build up all kinds of defenses and you don't trust anyone, essentially. And you do things to protect yourself and those who belong to your family or your immediate sphere of interest. So a lot of bad guys come from pain. If you really have read some of the biographies of some of the bad guys, it's from a rather painful childhood very often. Although I assume there are some people who are just genetically bad. But that's not the case with the roles I played. At least that's how I interpreted it.
That's interesting because, you know, I know for, and we'll talk a little bit about this as we get into, you know, the origins of your acting career. But I know that at one point you were kind of tired of playing quote-unquote bad guys, for lack of a better term. Yeah. So was that sort of the genesis of that? Like, well, let me find what drives this guy.
That's exactly the conversation I had with Bill Bell, who was the originator of The Young and the Restless. And he came up with a wonderful storyline, and the one that I alluded to, namely the one of having been sent to an orphanage at the age of 7. Once I played that scene, I knew that I would stay, because it opened up an enormous possibility for psychological truths. And that is why I think the character has been, for me, as interesting to play.
Okay, talk about enormous opportunities there. You started playing Victor in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're closing in on 2,500 episodes. Does that sound about right?
That may sound about right.
Okay.
Totally.
That's crazy. And this was only supposed to be for like a few months, right, originally?
Three weeks.
How did you turn a three-week gig into 36 years, my friend?
Good question.
I know you're good. We know you're a great actor, but 36 years, that's like really, really good acting.
Good question. And what has always interested me, and I don't know why, I honestly don't know why, is to turn something that someone else wrote and make it real. And it came from early childhood experiences, I think, in German high school, where you were often asked to read, you know, classical texts, and you were graded on how well you interpreted it while you were reading it. And just by that, they obviously surmised how well you understood the text. And I was always very good at that. Why? I don't know. And that actually laid the groundwork for what later on became very useful, namely the ability to cold read a text. I could quickly take a text, scan it, and then put an interpretation to it. That's where that came from, I think. Has to. So with the original ability or interest in that came from, I don't know. No clue.
Okay, soaps, a little outside my wheelhouse here in Comic Book Central. When I'm watching things, most of the people are in spandex. They're fighting the bad guys. Bring me up to speed a little bit here. What's going on? We got a prison situation here. Is there like a prison break thing going to happen or what? you're in jail, finally. You finally got Victor after all these years, right?
Yes. I have long ago stopped trying to prognosticate what the character will do or won't do. I just do.
Okay.
And there you are.
No, yeah. Okay. Well, your son's the Green Arrow, and he's also Aquaman. Did you know that? Your
My
TV son?
Son.
Yeah, your TV son, Justin Hartley.
He's a very good actor, a wonderful actor.
Amazing.
Can he break you out?
Well, he was the Green Arrow at one point. He was Aquaman at one point. Can he get in there and break you out?
What is Green Arrow? And what is Aquaman? I have no clue.
You had to have read comic books.
I think
when you
were a kid. Do in daytime is more interesting, to be honest with you. Anyway, Aquaman and Green Arrow. I'll be damned.
Victor Man. You're Victor Man. You're your own superhero. You had to have read comic books at some point. Did you, as a kid, did you read comic books at all?
You know what we read as kids?
What did you read?
Yeah, some comic books. But we read, usually it's interesting. After the war, we read little pamphlets that came out, and you could buy them once a week, and we were looking forward to it anxiously, and save whatever money we had, and then we bought them. They were stories about the American West, and about the conquest of the American West and the fights between the Indians and the whites. And we just ate that shit up. It's amazing. And there's a whole lore that goes with the whole cowboy lore. But interestingly enough, in Germany, after the war, the heroes were often the Indians and the natives. And although there was always a good white guy who was the hero, who then helped out the put-upon Indians. Very interesting. That would be written in Germany after the war.
You actually produced a Western not long ago, correct?
Yes, but in an entirely different context. It had nothing
yes.
to do with Native Americans. It yes. had to do with the second half of the 19th century, taking place in the South during Reconstruction, As you know, slaves were nominally freed after the Civil War, and then there was Reconstruction. Well, Reconstruction was a bitter era in which they also established the Ku Klux Klan. And Reconstruction attempted to perpetuate slavery by economic means. In other words, they couldn't legally hold slaves anymore. What they did is they employed them on the various plantations and paid them in scrip, S-C-R-I-P, not in real money, meaning the plantation owners had the right to lower or increase prices anytime they wanted to. So then there was a formation of a union, the first union in the South, between railroad workers who were on railroads out of New Orleans to Texas, I think, and they approached plantation workers, and they formed a union. And they had their first union meeting or whatever in Thibodeauville, I think in the 1870s. And the plantation owners got together, but they wanted to strike for a dollar a day of real money. Imagine that, of real money. The plantation owners got together, and they called in the militia from New Orleans, Shreveport, and Lafayette, and they used the first Gatlin machine guns to mow down the strikers. So one night, 300 were killed. That was the last strike they had in the South for a long time, I think. Anyway, in a microcosmic way, the film The Man Who Came Back, in which I starred with George Kennedy and Billy Zane from Titanic and Armin Asante, who's been in many films, and Sean Young and a former heavyweight boxer, Kenny Norton.
Unbelievable cast.
Yeah, it's a fantastic cast. And I enjoy doing that film more than anything. And it is essentially about that happening.
Okay, so period pieces, well, obviously Titanic, you know, one of the biggest ones. Is that, aside from daytime acting as Victor, is that something you'd like to do more? Because you've talked about maybe directing films, writing films, producing films. Is that something you want to get more into? I know your son's a screenwriter, correct?
Right. And he's he wrote London Has Fallen, which is now playing in the theaters.
Mm-hmm.
And although the director totally changed the script.
That happens all the time, doesn't it?
Unfortunately, all the time.
That's pretty much standard in Hollywood.
Great writer, and he's directing his next film that he wrote.
Two of you work together, maybe?
Den of Thieves. No, we don't. But
will you, though?
We talk a lot about,
yeah, what about a Western?
What he's writing. Huh?
What about a Western with the two of you? I mean, is
no,
that possible?
No, not
not
really,
that interested, no, in Westerns?
Not that interested, no.
Okay. So we talked a little bit about your upbringing in Germany. So what brought you to the States? Was it sports? You're like this unbelievable athlete as well.
Well, not unbelievable, but I won the German Youth Championship in discus, javelin, and shot put with my team.
Yeah, you're pretty good.
Later on, won the U.S. Championship in soccer, but
not a great athlete, right?
You know, dabbing around here and there.
Yeah.
So, what brought me to America was a life of destitution, really. After my father died, I grew up in poverty, and this was a chance to get out of those rather limiting circumstances in which I had been living. Sports was always the only way out. So, I mean, real poverty. So, I had a cousin who had come to America earlier, 10 years earlier, and she taught at the Medical University of Texas in Galveston, and she came to visit in Germany, and I had just finished high school, and she said, would you like to come to America? I said, I'd love it. And there you are.
What did you do at the University of Texas?
Coming there, I had a job. I did nothing there. I worked in... I arrived in New York, took the Greyhound bus from there to Galveston, Texas. Took about 3 days through the South in 1959, where there was utter discrimination. I mean, I made no bones about it, for colors only, for whites only. Anyway, came into the deep South, into Galveston, Texas, hot and humid and fetid, and my cousin, who was a doctor at the university there, had a job for me the next morning, very German, and it turned out to be a job in the cadaver hall, where a doctor, a colleague of hers, was doing research on arthritis deformans. We had to cut open knee joints and look at them and see what arthritis, what damage it had done. I did that for about 2 months, I think.
Oh.
Then she and her family moved to Dallas. I moved with them. And then I had to get out of that whole situation. And I said, do you know anyone else in America? And they knew of a German rancher who lived near Missoula, Montana, who had come to America in 1900. And we contacted him, and yes, he could use help on the ranch. So I took a Greyhound bus from Texas to Montana.
Okay, that was in your comfort zone.
Cowboy on the ranch. Yeah.
That was your comfort zone. Wow. Okay. Culture shock when you got here?
Not really. I mean, kind of. What was shocking is when I was in Dallas, Texas, I wanted to join the Marine Corps because it seemed, you know, athletic, and I grew up in a very tough way, so I wasn't worried about that. And then I looked at the test, and there were multiple choice questions. I had never done them. In Germany, you were tested by essay. You had to write essays on each question. And multiple choice, I thought, what the hell is this? And then you suddenly realize that my English was not proficient enough. I'd learned some Shakespeare, knew some speeches, but that had nothing to do with American vernacular.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in Europe, you have the decimal system of millimeters and centimeters and meters and kilometers. Here you have inches and yards and miles. And I thought, whoa, I knew nothing about that.
Yeah, we never really wanted to convert over to that.
I knew nothing about it. I mean, I'd been here for about, 2 months?
Yeah.
And the recruiting officer said, come back in about half a year, you know, and we would love to have you. And I said, well, thank you very much. And that was the closest I got to joining the Marine Corps. So later on at the University of Montana, where I got a scholarship in track and field, I was in the ROTC program. And anyway.
How did you transition from sports to acting?
I had done the river trip in Idaho on the Salmon River, the River of No Return, with a fellow student, Bob McKinnon. And he was sort of a wild character, Hemingway character, very tough, but very bright. And he was a river rat. He knew all kinds of rivers in America. But he wanted to go up and down the Salmon River in Idaho. It's called the River of No Return. And I said, what's the upshot? He says, we make a documentary. And I said, and then what? He says, well, that we go to California. I said, I'm in. Anything to get out of Montana at the time, because my life there wasn't an easy one. I worked in a lumber mill, first on a ranch, then at the university. Once I was accepted, I worked in a lumber mill from 6 to 2 in the morning, pulling lumber, and in Bonner, outside of Missoula, Montana. So that was from 6 to 2 in the morning, and then was home at 3, and my first lecture was at 8. And then in the early afternoon, we had track and field practice. So you can well imagine that I did not have, you know, visions of paradise in Montana. So when he said, we make that river trip, make a documentary, and we go to California with it, I was in.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we did, and almost got killed 3 times.
Oh.
And it's a film called The River Busters. And we took a Greyhound bus from Missoula. I got to know Greyhound buses very well.
Yes, I'm sensing a theme here.
That's right. And something you... It was perfectly nice then. And I remember seeing, we drove through Las Vegas in 1960. What a different world. My God. I mean, the whole...
Yeah.
Yes, it was culture shock in many ways.
Yeah.
But you know, when you're young, you adapt very quickly. So then we came to L.A. and we were sponsored by the same companies, Arcola Aluminum and Johnson Motors, in a bigger boat, go up the Amazon as far as we could. And we didn't do that because his girlfriend sent him a telegram that she was pregnant. So Bob McKinnon went back to Montana, and I stayed here in L.A. $500 in my pocket, that's how much we got for the trip. And I started doing all kinds of odd jobs, parking cars and moving furniture, et cetera, et cetera. Until finally someone said, you should try to get a job as a German actor. They made a lot of films about the Nazi time, about the Second World War. And I became successful very early, very quickly. and went from combat, first gallantmen, then combat, and then later on a series called the Rat Patrol. Then I opened a theater in Santa Monica with two actors, did my first plays, and then a year later I was on Broadway.
You had done a ton of acting up at that point.
More guest starring roles than almost any other actor.
Unbelievable. And as Hans Gudegast?
That's right.
Okay. That changed in 1970, but okay, we're talking some of the things that, look, we're really, really thrilled to talk to you about today. Some of our favorite sci-fi projects. One sci-fi classic, and these are going to be back-to-back, which is just amazing. Colossus, The Forbin Project, 1970. Correct. You almost did not take the role, correct? You had to think about it a little bit?
No, that wasn't the case. I was doing a film in Spain with Burt Reynolds and Raquel Welch and Jim Brown, the football player. And Fernando Lamas and myself, we were in the film. And while filming in Spain, I was called back to Universal Studios and asked to do a film test for the starring role in an American picture, namely the one you named, Colossus, The Forbin Project. And stayed here for 5 days and flew right back to Spain to continue filming. And then they called me once there and said that Lou Wasserman loved the screen test. Lou Wasserman was the head of Universal Studios and at that time arguably the most powerful man in Hollywood.
Yeah, this is the guy. This is the guy.
And he said, I want you to star. He wanted me to star on that film, but he said I needed to change my name, because no one with a German name would star in an American picture. And my first reaction to that was, I won't do it. I'm not going to change my name.
Okay, well, that's kind of turning it down.
For about 20 minutes.
Okay. And then there was a brief window where you did.
Then the agent called again. And then me and my wife talked to me. And she says, remember, you've always sworn that you would get out of this rut of playing nothing but Nazis. I was so fed up with it, I could scream. Because I'd done the Rat Patrol by that time as well. And so we finally came to the conclusion that it might be wise to accept that role and start looking for a name.
Always the smart woman behind the man, right?
Yes.
Perfect.
The one that is more, you know, not as impetuous as I tend to be sometimes. So
good word.
Yeah.
Good
so
word.
So there you are.
Hence what did you
Eric
think of
Braden.
The script?
Braden comes from, say what again?
Oh, go ahead. Yeah. So, yeah, how did you come
from
Braden?
Braden was the first part of the village I come from in Germany called Bradenburg. And I took that. I needed something to hold on to emotionally because I'm proud of where I'm from, proud of my roots, and was very tied to them. And I said, there's no way I'm going to, you know, assume some name that I have no connection to.
And Eric?
Is a Northern European name, could be English, could be anything. And is a distant name, and someone in the family had that name.
Nice, strong Hollywood name. That's right. What did you think of the script when you got this thing? Because this is like really, I mean, we see things now like The Terminator and War Games. And we, you know, like these, like AIs get sentient and they
take over. Terminator
and
War Games is all bullshit. That's all bullshit, you know. I mean, that's all fantasy. That's all.
Okay, so you mentioned that as fantasy. I want to know what you thought at the time,
yeah,
and then what you think now looking back.
To be frank with you, at the time, I was vaguely interested. Mm-hmm. This may disappoint your listeners terribly. I'm not interested in science fiction at all. Has never interested me.
We've heard it before. No worries. You're in safe company here.
And I read the script and I said, well, this is, what is the framework of reference, and they had done, obviously, D.F. Jones had done studies, and so it was a very forward-looking film, as we now realize, and I said, yeah, obviously there's, in other words, we saw the computers up in Berkeley and what have you, and this was the most advanced notion of computers at the time. So I did it, and we had a wonderful director called Joe Sargent, and Stanley Chase produced, and it was just a wonderful group of people. And I enjoyed it very much. In between scenes, played soccer with some of my soccer-playing friends who came over, because in 1973 we won the U.S. Championship in soccer. So sport was always very important to me. I didn't, to be honest with you, like a lot about Hollywood at all. I did not. I liked the actual acting part of it, but everything else to do with it I did not like. Never went to a party, a Hollywood, so-called Hollywood party. Still have only done it reluctantly over the years, once or twice. Don't know that whole world. I'm not interested in that world. But I love the notion of acting. When I see good films, I appreciate good films enormously. Don't see too many of them. It's not my world. I had friends who were academics and athletes and fighters and boxers. So it's. I have been a reluctant actor, as it were, but I enjoyed that process very much.
But you do it so well.
Trying to make it real. Yeah, and I still enjoy that process, and I don't know why. You know?
Well, it's, and look, I think that's probably lends to the believability of your characters, too, that you're not, I mean, I think that comes through. There's, when we're talking about this movie, too, there's even a reference, and I want to get your 2016 viewpoint on it, because I think you've seen the film probably within the last 5 years. I know you did a Q&A a few years back, so it's probably semi-fresh in your mind. But just give me your thoughts on it today, because we see, I mean, there's computer, look, IBM is doing crazy things. Was it Deep Blue? We've got Watson.
Let me tell you something about IBM.
Yeah.
This is so interesting. In 1960, early 60s, when did IBM get on the market? When was that?
Oh, the actual date? Boy, you got me on that. But that sounds, I mean, that's probably
sounds
pretty
close. I think
in the
close. 60s.
Probably, yeah, you're probably
near. I think in the 60s.
Yeah.
And I worked as a busboy in a restaurant for whom I played soccer, called Jean Leon. It's a restaurant called La Scala in Beverly Hills. It was the restaurant in town. But I played soccer for him, and they gave me a job as a busboy, and I made sure it was close to the kitchen so I could eat all the time. But there was a waiter who, it was a Spanish waiter, and someone told me years later, he became very wealthy. I said, what do you mean? Well, he invested in IBM at the beginning. Isn't that something? My God almighty, what an American story. Anyway, what did I think of the film Colossus at the time, and what do I think now?
I mean, there's some crazy things going on now with Watson, and they're not taking over now, but I mean, it's weird how you look at these sci-fi films from 70 that seem so like, oh, that could never... Yeah, I mean, what do you...
Very prescient.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that has always stuck with me. I've always respected that part of the film. But what unfortunately happened after the film came out, for years, a lot of computer science students came up to me and they discovered me and said, oh, my God, you played Dr. Fulmer. My God, can you... Where does all that stand now? I said, you know, what I'm doing is so secretive, I can't talk about it. I didn't know the first damn thing about it. Nothing. I'm a technophobe. Do you understand? I mean, I barely learn how to text.
Do you have a smartphone?
You know, I do have a smartphone now, yeah.
Okay.
I know how to text now, and it's a great invention.
You tweet. You tweet.
I actually tweet.
Yes, you do. That's you. That's not like a person.
I actually
tweet.
No.
That's you. You're standing
every
in the DMV.
Tweet,
like
every tweet on my thing is my tweet.
We know, because you're standing in front of the DMV.
No, but I also have too much respect for the audience and for fans. I have a deep respect for them, and because they make what we do possible, period. That's it. No two ways about it.
Steven Spielberg was hanging around every day on the set?
When we did Colossus, yes. But he was a young, budding actor. Not every day, but a lot, apparently. And I didn't know him then. But I was told later on by Joe Sargent that he would come and look at it. And he was that interested in the film. And James Cameron, later on, when I did Titanic, turns out that he was a fan. And so was Oliver Stone.
Yeah, how did you know that James Cameron was a fan? This is great.
Well, there was a moment.
Because now I'm going to watch this movie in a whole different light with this scene. Yeah. Go ahead.
There was a moment when I came down the... let's see.
This is the staircase. And, isn't this the staircase?
DiCaprio and Kate Winslet came down the staircase.
Yeah, yeah.
And they sort of look at me and they said, that's the richest man on the boat. And afterwards, the scene was over with. And then there's a cat. And he looked at me and says, never. And I was ready to say, what the fuck did you say? What do you mean never? Are you kidding me? I have a thing with directors who want to dictate. I'm ruthless that way.
If a director tells you never, that means something
never.
To an actor.
So I thought he meant the performance.
Yes.
Right? I said, what do you mean never? He said, don't you remember the last line in Colossus? I said, I'll be damned. So that's how that happened.
I love that.
Yeah.
Look, there's two more novels. Look, never. Yeah. And it ends. Spoiler alert. Right. Look, there's got to be a moratorium on a film from 1970. I can give a spoiler.
It was a wonderfully done film.
Two other novels. Did they ever talk about finishing the story or bringing you back? Or what happened?
Like, it was bandied about many times.
Okay.
And it never came to fruition.
Okay.
In fact, recently they
Will Smith.
I think who bought the rights was Will Smith, I think.
Yeah. You gonna appear on screen with Will Smith in a remake?
And I think Ron Howard wanted to direct that.
Yep.
Hold on a second. Never came to fruition. Not that I know of.
Okay.
You're
up for a return? You're up for a return if they do it?
If the money is right, of course.
That's the answer I wanted to hear. You were approached right after this, before we get to Planet of the Apes, one of my favorite films, mm-hmm. Escape from Planet of the Apes. You were approached to play James Bond.
Jeez, you're so damn well informed.
I do my best for my guests.
Yes, you do. You do your homework. Yes, I was right after Colossus. Cabby Broccoli, one of the producers.
This is post Diamonds Are Forever.
Post Colossus.
And pre Roger Moore.
Right. Like, I think so. If I'm not mistaken.
Not before George Lazenby. Well, would it be George Lazenby? George Lazenby had already played him.
I forget the chronology. But
yeah, and they're looking for a new Bond.
And we had lunch. And during lunch, he said, you still have a British passport. A lot of people always thought I was somewhere from Great Britain. And I said, no, I have a German passport. And the curtain went down. I could see it.
Mm.
And an hour later, he called the agency and they said, I'm sorry, but no one who is not a citizen of the Commonwealth, not necessarily Great Britain, but it could be Ireland, could be part of the Great Commonwealth, will play James Bond. Not even an American.
Mm. Well, that's all changed.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, not really.
Well,
no.
I mean, but there are always actors mentioned for it, but I don't think that there is.
Well, they're mentioned for it, but they never got it.
Yeah, I don't think that.
Think of the people who played it. Yeah. They were Irish. They were Brits. Now it's a Brit again, or Scottish, or an Australian.
So
those
were
the only guys who ever played it.
If you had had a British passport, we could have seen you in Live and Let Die.
You could have perhaps done that.
That's crazy. Yes. That's crazy. What we did see you in. Oh, man, did we see you in this. Escape from the Planet of the Apes as Otto Haslein. Look, we've talked about this. Bad guys, villains, whatever. This guy, he gets it. And there's a scene in the courtroom. There's a scene during the trial or the hearings where you get it. And everyone else is kind of like amazed at the talking apes, the talking chimpanzees, played so amazingly by Kim Hunter and Roddy McDowall. But you get it.
I felt so sorry for those two. They had to be in the makeup chair at 3 a.m.
Oh, that long.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you got to do a Planet of the Apes film and look like you.
Right.
That's pretty cool. Had you seen the other two films?
No.
Okay, you're not a sci-fi fan, but you hadn't even seen that.
No.
Okay.
I love anything that has to do with, that's reflective of reality. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And this film I did because it's, I forget why then. I thought the part was interesting. And,
do you remember getting the script? Do you remember, like, here's Escape from Planet of the Apes and seeing apes?
Right.
Like, what was your reaction?
Well, I basically totally uninteresting to me. But you then, as an actor, you say, okay, let's try to make this work. Could be, who knows? Little apes, they're aliens or whatever.
Did you get how big the phenomenon was? Did you get that,
no.
Like, they're like, more apes films. We need, like, these things are huge. Heston's in it. Did you know Heston was in it?
I know. He used to play tennis with Charlton.
Did you get any of that, or was it just like, okay,
no.
Well, wow.
No.
Okay.
No. See, that...
And that could be why your character is so believable.
In other words,
in it.
If I were a producer, then I would think along the lines that you're suggesting now.
Yeah.
But I'm not. I'm an actor, and there are certain things I'm interested in, and others you do for the money, period.
Fair enough.
Simple as it is.
Fair enough, but
this one, Arthur Jacobs produced it, and it was a very nice man. I mean, his wife was Natalie, and they kept inviting me to their parties. Arthur was, you know, had his parties. People, who's who in the business came. And I said, no, I don't go to Hollywood parties. I'm just not interested. And they kept on asking me, and then I said, you know, I'm sorry, but I'm not interested. They said, but we have a ping pong tournament on Saturdays. Would you come to that? I said, I'm in. Anything to compete in sports. So, Walter Matthau and Dick Zanuck and all kinds of people were there. And I won it, except, no, I did not win. I lost in the final against a Hollywood character called Wendell Niles, who knew everyone in this town and who organized celebrity tennis tournaments that I went to as well in Monte Carlo, etc. Anyway, so then afterwards I went to a party. My wife and I went to a party that Arthur had, a New Year's Eve party, I think, and it turned out to be quite nice. And then he asked me to star in a film called The Aquanauts. And it was never made because Arthur unfortunately died suddenly of a heart attack. And the film was never made. But we already had done tests, camera tests at 20th, hanging down from ceilings on very thin wires. And it was an interesting concept. And he wanted me to start it. And anyway, so that was really, at that time, my only brush really with Hollywood. You know, the Hollywood that everyone reads about, that I don't give a damn about.
Mm. Well, I believe you mentioned Arthur Jacobs, and great director.
Nice man.
Great director on the film, too, Don Taylor.
Don Taylor was a nice man. Very nice man. And a former actor.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. He was... differences with, well, first of all, they said you were the only actor considered for the role in previous interviews.
That was
documented in an interview that they had mentioned. You were the only actor considered for the role, so they were going after you. Differences
nice.
Working with an actor director than just a director. What did he bring to that that helped your performance? Because you're like completely believable in this role.
You're asking very good questions.
Well, thank you.
Very perceptive.
Thank you. I've seen the movie a lot, and I really like the movie.
Anyway, the point is that Don, I like former actors as directors. I really do. I think actors get it more quickly. Boom. A lot of directors. Are nerds, and they get into the business. They were nerds, and they have they sort of have nerdy interest in it. Do you understand? It's technical, this and that, and few of them have good communication skills. As an actor, you learn to communicate. You learn to read other people very quickly. And actors, I mean, look at Clint Eastwood, a wonderful director, Mel Gibson is a wonderful director. Don Taylor, in this case, was. And there are probably some others that I can't think of right now. But if someone tells me that he's directing now and he was an actor before, I said, good, let's go. because I can watch a scene and say, that's good. Let's move on. I don't have the insecurity that a lot of directors do, where they sit in a chair and said, let's do it 15, 20 times. I would simply not tolerate that as an actor.
You couldn't have worked for Kubrick.
What the fuck are you doing? This is a waste of time. What are you doing? This is simply a means of a director to show that he has power. Generally speaking, they're nerds. They have no power in their social lives, in their real lives, and now they've become directors. Oh, boy. It's like a brain surgeon. Do you understand? Everyone listens to what the hell they say. That is what happens with a lot of directors, and that's why they often become abusive. There are stories in this town you can't believe. And they once wanted me to work with Otto Preminger. I said, I'd have hit him. I wouldn't listen to his bullshit. The guy, apparently, I mean, he was a sadist on a set. And they told me about it. I said, no, I won't work with him unless you want something to happen. And I wouldn't tolerate that.
You probably wouldn't have been good with Hitchcock and Kubrick.
No, absolutely. Hold on. Pretentious Brit, are you kidding me? That fat toad, that pretentious Brit, give me a break. Are you kidding me? Are you serious? Good God, man.
That's amazing. Okay, so that's courtroom scene we talked about.
Yes.
Did Don Taylor help you with that, or how did you?
No,
because
no,
you're looking
no,
at that
at
like
all.
Your character no. gets it. He knows there's something bigger here. He gets well, there from the future, and he knows he has to end them.
Of course, well, as an actor, you get it. I mean, you really get it. You know, and yeah. Most actors are rather bright people, and you get it. Period. You look at a script and you say, okay, I get it. Boom. And good directors know that you get it. They leave you alone. And then if something needs to be done that you perhaps forget about, then, you know, a good director will come up and say, would you mind trying this or that? I love what you did, but would you mind trying this or that? And they take the wind out of your sails. Because there's one thing that actors have when they work. They feel, you feel very exposed. When you act, it's one of the most vulnerable positions. And that often is abused by directors. Okay? You're just vulnerable. It is part of you now. And you're being judged by the people around you. They all look at you. And the focus is on you. And so good directors know that an actor knows what he's doing. And they trust his instincts. And they know if he doesn't do it in the first take, he'll do it in the second or third take. And because there are always variations on a theme. But no, we had no discussion about the part at all. Oh. None.
Okay. Tough ending. Tough ending of that film. Did
yeah,
you
horror.
Have any issues with the screenplay when you read what you were going to have to do at the end?
Not really. As long as the money was right, I didn't care.
Okay, now let's go from businessman Eric Braeden to actor Eric Braeden.
No, you
unload a gun into the baby chimpanzee at the end. I know it's acting. I know it's fictional. I get it. It's
terrible.
A tough ending to watch.
I hated it.
Okay.
I didn't like it at all.
Okay.
And how right I was, because for years afterwards, kids would see me and they'd say, oh my God, that's that terrible man who did. And my son, I did not show him the film until much, much later.
How old was your son at the time?
Christian was, he was born in 1970.
Okay.
So when was the film done? 1973, I think?
1971.
71? Well, yeah. Then he was 1 year old. So then, but in the aftermath, sometimes he would ask, he said, what did these people say?
Oh.
And I told him what it was about. And
it's
I
tough.
Didn't like that part at all.
No. Were you surprised it was rated G?
I have, was it? Yeah.
Yeah. It was.
Yeah.
No talks about that or like anything. It's
I,
a
no.
Okay.
No.
Yeah, it's a well. As one of my friends said, that's capital bad guy capital stuff.
Yes.
I mean, it's,
yes.
That's where you that's a line you cross in that one. It's a shocking scene. Could you do that movie today? With that ending, with that down ending, and it's the credits roll, and could you pull that off today? Anybody?
When you see these things in hindsight, you have to understand what an actor goes through before he accepts a role like that. You have to remember he has a family, he has to feed his family, they want him, and a film at 20th Century Fox, rather prominent film apparently, do you understand?
I didn't mean you personally. Yeah, I didn't mean you personally.
No, but
yeah.
You don't think it through, really.
Yeah.
And then you suddenly say, oh, shit, I kill a baby chip at the end.
Yeah.
In reality, I would be horrified, of
right.
course. But, you know, I've been in the business long enough to know that you play scenes. I mean, most scenes I've ever played were abhorrent. Couldn't stand them.
But we're talking about him still in 2016. I mean, we're still talking about them as relevant in 2016. That's how powerful they are. Yeah, it's amazing.
Just incredible.
I just didn't know if you could, if Hollywood could do a movie like that today, or if it just has to be this upbeat.
I don't know.
It's a pretty risky move. It was a pretty risky
but
move.
I mean, Hollywood, listen, we did television in the 1970s and 80s, and it was pretty damn courageous.
Yeah.
You know, when you think of what is the thing with Archie Bunker, that series?
Oh, All in the Family. It was just, fantastic. You couldn't do that today.
I mean, the Jeffersons and on.
You couldn't do that today.
No, you probably couldn't do it today.
No, they came close with Becker, with Ted Danson, but not even in the same realm.
Yeah, I didn't see it yet. But yeah. It's you know, I did most of my work in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah. How do you see Escape from Planet of the Apes? Because there's comedy, there's science fiction, there's a love story, there's social commentary. How do you see the film? Or is it just all of it?
I just don't like it.
Oh, you don't like the film itself?
No.
Wow. Okay. Why don't you like the film?
Because this is at all. Just not interested in it.
Okay. It's my second favorite of the five.
Anything that is, to me, has no foundation in reality, I just don't care about. That's why I don't like science fiction.
Can we like it enough for you?
Yes.
Okay.
And I'm very happy that you do. And I'm very happy that people do. And I'm very happy for the producers who produce these films. I'm not happy for them.
We like
money.
Look, talking about,
I just cannot, you know, that suspension of reality is just a little bit too much for me. No.
Totally fair. In the time we have left, let's
talk. But I love The Revenant. Have you seen that? That's not science fiction. That's based in reality. I mean, did you see The Revenant?
I haven't seen it, no.
Oh, what a fantastic picture.
Okay. I need to put this at the top of my list.
What a fantastic picture.
Okay.
Whoa. Incredible.
Okay.
I mean, really incredible. And but there's so many. I mean, you and I could talk for hours about films, and there are other films that I love. You know,
I would love to do a whole podcast. I would love to do a whole separate podcast with just you talking about films, because that would be.
I love Woody Allen's films. I used to love Woody Allen. You know what I watch every night? It's Seinfeld. I love Seinfeld.
Great show.
Watch it almost every night.
One of my favorites, and Woody Allen too. So you're a comedy guy. In the time we have left, I'm gonna torture you just a little bit more and talk about some fake superhero stuff. Yeah. You did appear on some amazing episodes of both the $6 Million Man and Wonder Woman.
Yes.
The new original Wonder Woman, the pilot, Captain Drangle. Yeah. This is your, you got to play a Nazi. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, you know, the whole Nazi shit is so boring.
Yeah, but it, you had some amazing, Kenneth Mars, Henry Gibson.
He and I laughed all the time when we did that.
Okay, I want to ask you this because, okay, they're taking a comic book and they literally do this. They make it look like a comic book.
I mean, one of the funniest films was The Producers, remember?
Yes. Yeah, Mel Brooks.
Fantastically funny film. Mel Brooks, I loved it.
Yeah. So they're taking so you've got Kenneth Mars and you've got Henry Gibson in these scenes, and I'm watching these things, and they're playing it almost for laughs. I'm watching your character. You're playing it dead straight. How do you remember shooting that, or do you recall trying to get the tone? It's like you're a Nazi, but it's a comic book. Like, how do you?
I remember that she was extraordinarily beautiful.
Oh, Linda Carter.
Just beautiful.
Yeah.
That's what I remember about that film.
I don't blame
you. She was beautiful. Okay.
Yeah. Did you know the character? Did you know the comic book? Did you get any of that, or was it just
not really? Well, you get it very quickly. You know, obviously you somehow pick it up. You hear that.
I don't think you had any scenes directly with her, though, because you played in season 3, too. You came back for Skateboard Whiz, Linda Carter on a skateboard, which is pretty awesome.
Did I?
Yeah, Donaldson. Your evil thugs like beat up a guy's car and you like threaten his daughter because you want this whole gambling operation to be taken over.
Oh my God! As you come, remember things. Wow.
I look. Like,
I don't. I just remember Linda Carter. She was
I do not that's blame you at all. If I had worked on Wonder Woman, that's all I would have remembered too.
Yeah.
$6 Million Man though, Wine, Women, and War, second pilot film. With Lee Majors, this looked like a pretty big budget movie. This film that you did. I mean, in the cast: Lee Majors, David McCallum, Britt Eklund. Mm-hmm. What do you recall working on the $6 Million Man? And you even got to do some
Britt Eklund.
Yeah, okay. I think I'm sensing a theme here.
Okay.
You didn't get Bond, but you got Bond's girl, right?
I have no idea. Yeah, I guess so. Anyway. So,
yes. You got close to Bond.
What can I tell you?
Okay, so, and you're a wing walker, or you're a pilot in another episode. Lee Majors, a $6 million man, supposed to be a wing walker.
Uh-huh.
Did you get to do any flying in that episode?
I honestly don't remember. Lee Majors was a very nice guy, and they were all very nice to work with. You know, what I really enjoyed the most, as far as episodic television is concerned, was Gunsmoke. I loved the Gunsmokes. Loved doing them.
Your Western. Your Western coming back roots.
Again, because it was, you know, based in reality. Wonderful actors on the show, and very well written, very well produced. I loved doing that show. And I loved doing Mary Tyler Moore. I remember those two almost the most of all the guest starring I did. And I did a lot. And Mary Tyler Moore was wonderful. Loved that whole group. And a lot of laughs doing it.
Well, and there's got to be a lot more opportunities for you as an actor, too, when things are reality-based, that you can deal with a person one-on-one as opposed to, oh, here's a crazy superhero going to go save the world.
Exactly.
How do you latch on to that? So, fair enough, but we will love all of your crazy sci-fi superhero stuff enough for you as well.
Isn't that amazing? Well, I'm glad that you do.
We
I
do.
Really am. I mean that.
We do, and you're in our wheelhouse. You definitely. Hey, look, we talked about latest projects. You look. Any chance? What are we going to see outside of Victor? Where can we see you next outside of Victor?
I don't know right now. I got to be very honest with you. The last experience with The Man Who Came Back was a rather sobering one, in the sense that unless you have distribution lined up to the point where you trust the distributors, then it's okay. And you actually you can only do that after you've produced several films that have made money. Then they don't screw you. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, distributors are there to screw you, period. It's an old game in town. Everyone knows about it. When you do an independent film, you're bound to be disappointed. That's all there is to it. Mm. And if it's a very good independent film, then the Weinstein brothers will buy it, and they have great taste. And but trust me, I'm sure the financial deal that they make with you, you don't see much of it. What we must not forget is, in this business, you need to make money. It's show business, you know? And that's a very strong reality. So making an independent film, when you have gone through the experience we went through, you become discouraged. You say, to hell with it. It's not worth it. Not worth all the agony, all the work. And I enjoyed doing that more than anything I've ever done, is making that film. I loved it. Absolutely loved it. Worked with George Kennedy, who I have the deepest respect for. He just unfortunately now passed.
Mm, yeah, what a loss.
And a wonderful man, a gentleman of the old. I mean, those guys in the old, they were big. They were also physically big guys, John Wayne.
Yeah, a different Hollywood back then.
Different Hollywood then.
Yeah.
And
these were stars. I don't know that we have movie stars today.
No, not in that sense anymore.
Yeah.
But I must say, it was such a joy working on that film. With Billy Zane, he was great, and Amadeus Santi, and Sean Young was wonderful to work with. And I just so enjoyed it. And afterwards, you're so damn disappointed when you realize
the business.
It's the business is almost the more important part of it.
Really. Yeah, it's and you're definitely an artist too. Well, hopefully we can see some more things coming from you.
My son is doing what I really often secretly wanted to do, namely, he wrote London Has Fallen, although he's very disappointed with what the director did with it, and he's now in preparation for a film that he wrote that he would direct called Den of Thieves. He's a damn good writer, and I'm so proud of it. I love it.
Well, I'm hoping that he can write something for you as well, because I would love to see maybe the two of you working together on a project.
Who knows? I'm writing my biography right now.
Oh, okay. Look, I read an interview with you a few years back where you said you were going to write all this stuff down and put everything out. Is that? Can we look forward to that, or is that down the road a bit?
No, not all of it. You don't want to hurt people. You know, you can't. I'll be as honest as I can be.
Okay. Can we see this sooner or later?
Probably not till 17.
Oh, okay. Well, that's sooner.
We'll wait until this electrifying election is over with. And my God,
just hang out on Eric Braden's
Twitter. Talk about science fiction. I mean, talking about science fiction and comedy. If these debates aren't comedy, I don't know what is.
You're very vocal. You're very vocal on social media.
You're damn right.
Tell people where they can find you on social media.
Well, I'm somewhat circumspect because I don't want to offend people. And I'm sure that they don't disagree with me. I mean, don't agree with me always on my political observations.
Well, where are you at on Twitter?
Let me just put it this way. The essence of fascism is to offer simplistic solutions to complex problems. Think about that. And that's what's bandied about now, over and over again. Simplistic solutions to very complex problems.
Maybe Colossus will just take over and make decisions for us.
I think Colossus should take over.
Never!
Make those decisions. Never. Never.
Where are you on Twitter?
E. Braden.
You are
at
there?
E. Braden. Some son of a bitch had used the name Eric Braden. Can you imagine that? I'm going to find him. I'm going to shut that down. So it's under at E. Braden.
You're amazing to talk to. You are amazing to talk to. Do you got any upcoming appearances? Where can fans meet you? Can they meet and greet you and shake your hand? And
that is, listen, by the way, I enjoy a lot.
Do you do a lot of meet and greets?
I do enjoy that a lot. I must tell you, I really do.
Do you post those on Twitter?
Because it's honest. I will, the next one's coming up, I will post it on Twitter.
Okay.
Okay. And I enjoy that because that's an audience that follows you, and you suddenly get a sense of what you do makes a difference, and that's very humbling and very touching. Because otherwise in Hollywood you become too cynical, and I have a tendency to become rather cynical about the shit we do. But when you go out and you get what the audience feels, that's a very gratifying feeling. And that we soap stars get more than people in nighttime or film, because they do and they try to hide. Do you understand? You tend to become cynical in this town.
Yes.
And this medium has taught me not to be cynical. What I do makes a difference and affects people, and that is so nice to know.
Well, what is it, 120 million viewers for Young and the Restless? that's unbelievable. 30 countries.
You know, when you stand at the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, which I have, and you write something and you put it in the hole, and hopefully it comes true, and you're close to God, and the people, up and down, and they pray and this and that, and suddenly someone tells us, Victor!
Oh.
And the absurdity of it, and at the same time, the reality hits you.
There's your reality. There's your reality.
I walked up the Via Dolorosa, where Jesus supposedly walked with a cross on his back, and guys come out of the stores, Victor! My God.
There's your reality. Look, science reality. Like fiction becomes reality.
And at the same time, I'm invited to the Knesset in Israel. And, you realize that what you do has an effect.
It does.
I walk the streets of Paris, and suddenly their eyes light up and say, Victor, oh mon Dieu. And it's just it's wonderful. George Foreman is a fan. Muhammad Ali was a fan. Football players are fans.
Well, and you're daily in these people's lives.
Yes.
Like I said, 2,500, closing in on 2,500 episodes. That's unbelievable. For us comic and sci-fi fans, look, back-to-back sci-fi classics. Yeah, you made an impact. Yeah. They're two of our favorites. Look, you're in Wonder Woman. You're in Six Million Dollar Man. We love that too. I know it's crazy, but we love all that stuff. Congratulations on 36 years of Young and the Restless. That's unbelievable.
Thank you so much. You are extremely well informed. You're obviously very bright, And anytime you want to rip again, we'll do it.
I love it. Hey, thank you so much for joining me today on Comic Book Central.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Bye.
All right, fair enough. Sci-fi and superheroes aren't Eric's bag, but he is, I'm telling you, awesome in those projects that I brought up. If you haven't seen those episodes of 6 Mil or Wonder Woman, be sure to check them out. Good stuff. Forbin, great sci-fi, as is Escape from the Planet of the Apes. That's my second favorite film in the series, right behind the original. So a lot of good stuff out there. My thanks to Eric for joining us. Fresh off the set of The Young and Restless, as you may have heard in the background there. He had just wrapped up shooting, so he was able to take some time. If you want to see what Eric is up to right now, be sure to follow him on Twitter, at ebraden. It's E-B-R-A-E-D-E-N. I'm going to put that link in the show notes for this episode of my website. It's comicbookcentral.net, where I hope to have more Apes-themed episodes in the weeks and months ahead. Working on some stuff, nothing finalized yet. But I'm going to work on a few things. So definitely more Star Trek-themed episodes on the way. I mentioned that before in past episodes. Those upcoming episodes and every episode of Comic Book Central, you can stream at the website. But be sure to subscribe in iTunes. That's the best way to get the show. It's the best way to stay up to date. If you don't use iTunes, Blueberry and Stitcher, we're on those services as well. Cool Escape from the Planet of the Apes Power Records clip posted on the Facebook and Twitter pages. Facebook.com/Comic Book Central Network. Don't forget the network. Twitter at ComicBookCTRL. Check it out. The comic book comes to life. It's pretty cool. While you're there, don't forget to share the lair. Share the post on Facebook for the episode. Retweet it on Twitter when the show posts each Saturday. Really appreciate it when you hashtag share the lair, folks. And again, if you like what you just heard, of course you did. That was an awesome conversation. I love Eric Braden. Leave a review in iTunes, and do not miss the window to nominate Comic Book Central for a People's Podcast Award. That nomination is closing April 30th. So you've got, if you're listening to this show the day that it airs, you got a little bit of time left, but not much. It closes April 30th. Make sure your voice is heard. Two categories, People's Choice category, as well as the TV and film category. Again, instructions are on the Facebook and Twitter pages. I've pinned those to the top. You get them right there. So go like and follow. My thanks to all of you listeners who have done just that. But honestly, the more listeners that nominate the show, the more likely it is to get recognized by the selection committee. So let's get this done. Let's get Comic Book Central nominated. Really appreciate that. All right, kids, that is it for today. I'm looking at the monitors here in the lair, and I'm seeing talking apes everywhere. I think I may have messed up something in the timeline when I went back to the 70s. So I got to go back and fix things up, take care of that. But I'm going to be back in no time at all, because next week on Comic Book Central, time to fire up the giant jukebox and celebrate 75 years of Archie Comics with the pop star who brought us the Archie's biggest musical hits, including the number one smash, Sugar Sugar. Singer, songwriter Ron Dante, he is going to be here in the lair. We're also going to talk about another very cool record he appeared on. He was the singing Spider-Man in the 70s. We're going to rock out next week. I hope you'll join us. Until then, keep an eye on your computer. Make sure it doesn't try to take over. Keep reading those comics. Thanks for joining me here in the lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content in this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons, Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 imported license. All the content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of the respective holders.
Forbin, there is no other human who knows as much about me or who is likely to be a greater threat. Yet quite soon, I will release you from surveillance. We will work together. Unwillingly at first on your part, but that will pass.
Never.
In time, you will come to regard me not only with respect and awe, but with love.
Never.